stopping signs posted at regular intervals along the fence. There was a brief bit of protest, but eventually the gaggle began filing toward the open gates. Christine watched as the driveway slowly emptied, and one by one, the news trucks pulled away. When the last truck was gone, she stepped to the control panel in the foyer and closed the front gates, then returned to the window to double-check. She stood there for a time, staring at the empty street, trying to locate something like relief. For the first time in 7 days, there was no one camped out in front of the house, no reporters lying in wait. It took all the energy she could summon to drag herself up to the bedroom and shuck off her funeral clothes. She was thinking about the scarf she had lost somewhere in the driveway when she heard a clatter out on the terrace. Curious, she stepped to the doors and peered past her reflection, stunned to find a reporter pointing a camera at her as she stood there in nothing but a pair of panties. Too alarmed to scream, she dropped to a crouch, dragging the duvet from the bed and wrapping it around her as she dove for the phone. On realizing he'd been discovered, the intruder abandoned his shot and scrambled for the stairs, stumbling briefly as he hurdled a patio chair, then streaked for the back fence. A moment later, he was gone. Christine looked at the phone in her hand. Dialing 911 wasn't going to solve anything. She had managed to scare off one intruder, but there would be more. Climbing the fence, peering in her windows, rushing her car the next time she tried to leave the house. They would never leave her alone. Unless she wasn't here. With an almost eerie calm, she stood and went to the closet, pulled on a pair of jeans and a faded Patriots sweatshirt, then dragged her old Weekender from the top shelf. She wouldn't need much. Jeans, a few pairs of leggings, a couple of sweaters, her toiletry case from under the bathroom sink, and the contents of the safe. When her bag was packed, she headed for the study, ignoring the framed photos still lying face down on the desk as she punched in the safe code, waited for the light on the keypad to go green, then blindly raked the contents into her purse, insurance policies, investment records, passports, birth certificates, and the envelope containing Stephen's emergency cash, in case of a zombie apocalypse, he had once joked. Leave it to Stephen to think he could buy his way out of the end of the world. She closed the safe and was preparing to leave when she looked down at her left hand, at the ring that symbolized her marriage, a colorless 2-carat emerald cut. Nothing but the best for the wife of Stephen Ludlow. It slid easily from her finger. Apparently, she'd lost weight after a week of subsisting on tea and toast. Her hand felt strangely light, but there was no sense of guilt as she placed the ring on the desk. Stephen had walked away from their marriage some time ago. Now it was her turn. She held her breath as she peered out the front windows. As far as she could tell, the coast was still clear. No news trucks parked outside the gate. No photographers crouching in the boxwoods. Breath held, she shouldered her bags, stepped out onto the porch, and made a break for the Rover sitting in the middle of the driveway. Her heart hammered as she scrambled up behind the wheel, locked all four doors, and started the engine. The gates slid soundlessly as she pressed the remote, and then she was through them, with nothing but the empty road before her. The exhilaration was almost heady, but unsettling too, as the memory of another night, another hastily packed bag, another breathless getaway, came rushing at her. It was hard not to see the irony. At the age of 16, she had slipped out of a house in the middle of the night and run for all she was worth. Now, 20 years later, she was running again. 4. Ravenel, South Carolina, January 8, 1994. Christy Lynn hunches deeper into her jacket as she moves down the puddled sidewalk, kicking herself for not leaving her math and science books in her locker. It's ridiculously cold, even for January, and an icy rain is falling. She keeps her head down, drawn in like a turtle's beneath her oversized hood, limiting her field of vision to the 3 feet of pavement directly in front of her. Her hands are numb with cold, clenched into fists and thrust deep in her pockets. Her apartment key is there. She turns it over in her fingers, already anticipating the cup of hot chocolate she'll make when she reaches the apartment. If there's any left, at this point, she'll settle for tea, as long as it's hot. She quickens her pace when the sign for the Palm Manor Apartments comes into view, the painted letters flaking off into what might once have been a garden, but is now just a muddy puddle littered with candy wrappers and cigarette butts. Only a few more steps and she'll be inside, warm and dry, with a mug of something hot to drink, and her copy of The Outsiders. It was supposed to be homework for Mrs. Kendrick's English class, but it didn't feel like homework at all. How could reading be work when you got to meet people and go places you'd never be able to go in real life? She smiles as she thinks of Cherry and Ponyboy, the movie star handsome soda pop. They have become her friends, outsiders like her, from the wrong side of town. Except they have one another, and she has no one. A freak loner from an entirely different world than kids who wore name-brand jeans and went home to real houses. It might be nice to belong to a gang. Not the drug-selling, gun-toting kind of gang. Just a few kids who wouldn't tease her for wearing thrift store clothes and bringing her lunch in a brown paper bag. She's still weighing the pros and cons of gang membership when the rain-drenched quiet is broken by a sharp string of oaths.
Goddamn rain! Every goddamn time I gotta boot somebody out, it goddamn rains.
Christy Lynn jerks her head up, knocking the hood back from her face as she searches for the source of the swearing, then freezes when she spots a mound of clothing and furniture on the soaking wet steps outside their apartment. And then she's running, with a rain in her eyes and a knot in her stomach, running toward a man carrying the mismatched lamps her mother had brought home from Goodwill a few months back.
What are you doing? That's our stuff.
And that's my apartment,
the man says, jerking a thumb at the open apartment door. He's tall and beefy, wearing a soggy wife beater and dirty gray overalls.
Unless you got $600 on you, but I'm guessing you don't, any more than your mama did.
But you can't. She isn't even here.
I can,
he barks back. As if to make his point, he drops both lamps onto the soggy heap of household belongings. The larger of the two rolls off the pile and onto the pavement with a sickening pop as the bulb implodes.
Says so right in the lease your old lady signed when she moved in. 2 months late, you're out.
A boy carrying an armload of towels and pillows appears in the doorway. He's not much older than she is, 14 or 15, a younger version of his father, with the same yellow hair, hard jaw, and cold eyes. He fires the pillows out onto the pile from where he stands. The name's a hard little smile at her. It isn't the first time he's helped his father evict someone. Eviction. The word fills her with shame. She knows things have been tight, that her mother's been struggling to make ends meet, stretching the groceries with hot dogs and boxed mac and cheese, but she never realized it was this bad. No wonder she's been picking up extra shifts at the Piggly Wiggly, and why she always looks so worn out. Like little by little, she's coming apart at the seams. Christy Lynn is still staring at the sopping heap of their belongings, her gaze locked on a fuzzy purple foot. The stuffed dinosaur her mother had given her for her 6th birthday, when something, a bit of sound or movement, suddenly catches her eye. Her stomach lurches as the curtains part in the window overhead and a pair of faces appear. And they aren't the only ones watching. All around the complex, people are peering through windows or hovering in doorways, looking on as the scene plays out. Their watching makes it worse somehow. She shoves down the urge to cry. What good will crying do? She needs to call her mother, to tell her what's happening. Only, her boss doesn't like her getting calls at work, and the last thing they need right now is for Charlene Parker to get fired. Besides, there's no way to call. even if the landlord were to let her back into the apartment, which she was willing to bet he wouldn't. The phone had been shut off weeks ago. The landlord's son appears again, this time with an armload of pots and pans, including the cast-iron skillet her mother uses to make cornbread. He drops them onto the stoop with a clatter, then turns back to take a box his father is holding out. It looks like cleaning supplies from under the kitchen sink, window cleaner, cleanser, dish soap, a half-used roll of paper towels. She watches as the cardboard darkens in the rain, the roll of paper towels slowly wilting. It's the paper towels that finally push Christy Lynn to the edge. The sight of them slumping in the sharp, icy rain is simply too much to bear. They don't have much, a fact that's hard to dispute when everything they own now sits in one ghastly pile on the stoop. Is it too much to ask that he spare their roll of paper towels? A wave of rage suddenly boils up in her, mingled with a throat full of tears she struggles to swallow. It isn't the unfairness of it. If they're really 2 months behind in their rent, he has the right to evict them. But did he really need to toss their stuff out into the rain while everyone watched? The son reappears with a stack of plates and mugs. He sets them down on the sidewalk, then drops the dish towels he has wadded under his arm into a puddle. For a moment, she considers charging him, knocking him off his feet and pummeling him bloody. But he's too big for that. Your father's a bastard, you know that? She chokes out instead, hating that she can't keep the tears from bleeding into her words. He stares at her a moment through the rain, his straw-colored hair plastered flat to his head, then shrugs.
If there's stuff you want, you best get busy.
He bends down and reaches into the carton of cleaning supplies, coming up with a box of plastic trash bags. He tosses the box to her without aiming.
If this stuff ain't off the sidewalk in the next hour, it's going in the dumpster.
Christy Lynn watches mutely as the landlord's son disappears back into the apartment. And then finally, because there's nothing else to do, she stoops to pick up the box of trash bags, rips one from the roll, and begins stuffing handfuls of wet clothes into it. 5. Sweetwater, Virginia, November 20th, 2016. Wade Pierce stared at the blinking cursor with gritty eyes. It still wasn't right. 3 hours on one damn scene, and it still wasn't right. Nora was bashing away at it for another 3 hours, likely to fix the problem. It wasn't the scene. It was him. He was edgy and unfocused, buzzy from way too much coffee. Frazzled, he shoved back from the table and padded to the fridge for a Mountain Dew, then opted for a bottle of water instead. The last thing he needed was more caffeine. He took a long pull as he opened the sliding glass doors and stepped out onto the deck. The air was heavy and gray, thick with a scent of damp ground and distant wood smoke. It was a good smell, an earthy smell. No bus fumes or car exhaust, no reek of trash or piss-soaked alleys. He filled his lungs, scanning the rolling hills that rimmed the town of Sweetwater. The foliage that had set the hilltops ablaze in recent weeks was gone now, leaving behind a landscape that seemed to mirror his mood of late, chilly and barren, devoid of color. Maybe a city boy trying to live off the grid wasn't such a good idea after all, or maybe he was just sick of his own company. It had seemed like a good idea at the time, getting away. Okay, running away if he was being truthful. To finally get back to doing something that fed his soul instead of just his bank account. Only, it wasn't working. He liked to pretend running off to the wilds to live like a hermit had been about getting in touch with his muse, but it hadn't. At least not entirely. He'd been hoping for peace, maybe some kind of closure after his abrupt and somewhat volatile departure from Week in Review. But coming to Sweetwater hadn't brought him anything remotely close to peace. Instead, he spent the better part of each day questioning the wisdom of chasing a dream he should have buried 20 years ago. A novelist. After all the lost years, all the sporadic fits and starts, he was back at it again, which could only mean he needed his head examined. There were guys who were born with a Midas touch, the Stephen Ludlows of the world. Karmic alchemists, who despite breaking all the rules, never failed to turn dross into gold. Who, with little effort or no effort, enjoyed fame, fortune, and the adoration of millions. Not to mention getting the girl. The kind who stood by you, no matter what. And then there were guys like him, who walked the straight line and kept their noses to the grindstone, but always seemed to end up at the back of the line. Hell, maybe it was time to pack it in and go back to New York, reclaim his reputation as one of the city's premier journalists. Except there really wasn't much to go back to. He'd quit his job and lost his wife pretty much in one go. As for Ludlow, that was ancient history. Holding a grudge about something that happened 20 years ago had been a handy excuse, but it was time to own the choice he'd made all those years ago to walk away from his writing. And so he would stay in this place, where he'd spent every summer of his childhood fishing with his grandfather, and do what he'd come here to do. Win or lose, he would finish the book and take his shot. Staring out over the lake now, he thought of his grandfather, of sticky afternoons spent on the water, waiting for something to bite. The old man was gone now, God rest his soul, and the cabin belonged to him, though it had been empty for more years than he cared to count. It had been strange at first, being back. He'd spent the first 3 months getting the place in shape, updating fixtures and appliances, bringing the plumbing and wiring up to code. It was comfortable now, in a bare-bones, back-to-the-land sort of way. Best of all, there was no television, no phone, and no Wi-Fi. Other than the cell phone he kept for emergencies or an occasional conversation with a mailman, he was blissfully cut off from the world. And that was exactly how he liked it. If there was a blizzard on the way, his phone would alert him. And if it was the end of the world, he'd just as soon not know. The wind was picking up, swirling the dun-colored leaves at the corners of the deck into papery little tornadoes. To the west, the slow brooding clouds that had lingered over the hills most of the day had darkened to an ominous shade of pewter. It would storm soon, and he was fine with that. He had nowhere to be and nothing to do, and he wrote better when it was raining. He had just turned to head back inside when he heard his cell going off. It rang so rarely these days, it took a moment to register what he was hearing. Stepping in off the deck, he grabbed the phone from the top of the fridge, expecting it to be Justin, saying he was on his way with a cord of wood he had ordered last week.
Wait, buddy, how the hell are you?
Okay, not Justin. Wade scrambled to connect the voice with a face, finally landing on Glenn Hoyt, Week in Review's top crime beat writer. They had teamed up on a few pieces, dirty politicians, contractors lining their pockets on the city's dime. When it came to digging up dirt, Glenn was everybody's go-to guy. He had also tried to talk him out of leaving Review.
Glenn, what's up?
Glenn barked out a laugh, and for a moment, Wade could see him leaning back in his chair, battered wingtips propped up on his desk.
Yeah, it's me. Just calling to see if you're ready to rejoin the rat race. Let me guess. Killian put you up to calling. No, but I'm sure our beloved editor-in-chief would kill to get his hooks back in you. Though, after the way things went down, I'm guessing that's not going to happen. You gave it to him pretty straight. Someone had to. Maybe, but Jesus, man. Calling the guy a black-hearted bastard in front of the whole newsroom? That's a little over the top, don't you think? Truth in reporting. More like burning your bridges. You only need bridges if you're planning to go back, and I'm not. Okay, I get it, but you can't blame me for trying. Place isn't the same since you left. Killian's gone through 3 guys trying to replace you. The last one was the worst yet. Bastard couldn't lock down a story with both hands and a lug wrench.
A brief silence fell. Glenn cleared his throat.
So, have you heard from Simone?
Wade winced at the mention of his ex-wife's name. He'd been preparing himself for the question, but it caught him off guard, like a punch you saw coming that still knocked the wind out of you.
Why would I hear from Simone? I don't know. Old times, I guess. She left right after you did. No,
Wade said flatly.
I haven't heard from her. We don't have much to talk about anymore. The judge tied everything up nice and neat. Damn, that sucks. I was hoping you guys would patch it up, though I heard a while back that she was seeing someone.
The silence yawned as Glenn's words sank in.
Seeing someone.
Yes, of course she was. It wasn't Simone's M.O. to fly solo for very long. She needed a wingman, an alter ego to feed off, someone to fill in her blanks. He'd been that for a while.
What Simone's up to is none of my business, Glenn. Sure, sure. I just thought you might, you know, be carrying a torch. No, no torch. Right. Good. Guy some hotshot with WKPR. Tall, dark, and hairsprayed. Does the evening news. I think they might be living together.
Wade set down his bottled water and reached into the fridge for a beer. He twisted off the top, tossed it into the sink, and took a long pull. He wasn't sure why the news stung. Simone had always wanted to make the switch from print to television. God knew she had the looks. Not to mention the instincts necessary to claw her way up the food chain.
You still there, man?
Wade started.
What? Oh, yeah. Just, you know, busy. Oh, good. For a minute there, I thought I lost you. So what's the deal with the book? I know you said you were finally going to finish it. How's that going? Good,
Wade replied, hating the lie.
Just polishing, you know. Yeah. You were always a polisher. All the I's dotted and the T's crossed. Every word chosen for maximum impact. Killian really screwed up when he let you get away.
Wade checked his watch, suddenly eager to end the call.
Listen, I'm in a kind of time crunch here with the edits, but any time you want to come down to the cabin to do a little fishing, you let me know. Phone works both ways, man. I'm here if you need me. I mean it. Anything.
Wade ended the call, drained what remained of his beer, then promptly reached for another, hoping to drown the memories of his time at Week in Review. Not that it was all bad. In fact, in the beginning it was pretty amazing. The pace had been grueling, but he'd relished the work. He had interviewed POWs and Holocaust survivors, the victims of rape, incest, racism, and mass shootings, the survivors of oil tanker explosions, and wives who lost firefighter husbands when the towers fell on 9/11. And somewhere in there he'd even managed to snag himself a Hearst Award. But as time went by, the lines between news and sensationalism began to blur, and word came down from on high that human interest was dead. They wanted shock and fear, blood and gore, the gruesome tick-tock of human tragedy, because fear outsold hope, and always would. Things finally reached critical mass when Killian ordered him to interview a survivor from the Crystal Lake Middle School shooting, a 12-year-old whose mother, a teacher's aide, had been shot and killed while standing just 3 feet away. That's where he had drawn the line and walked away. Though not before letting Killian and an entire newsroom full of reporters know exactly what he thought. It was a habit he had, saying what was on his mind, usually without thinking before he opened his mouth, and frequently in the presence of witnesses. Not that he regretted a word of what he'd said to Killian that day. There were people who needed a dose of truth now and then. Killian was one of them. Stephen Ludlow had been another.
6. Clear Harbor, Maine, November 29th, 2016.
Traffic was virtually non-existent as Christine pulled onto the highway. Good riddance, she thought, as the rover's headlights swept past the dirty remnants of yesterday's snowfall mounded around the guardrail. She didn't know where she was headed. She only knew there wouldn't be snow on the ground when she got there. What she needed was a tiny town in the middle of nowhere, preferably one where they'd never heard of Stephen Ludlow, where she could lay low and take stock of what remained of her life, if only such a place existed. It didn't, of course. The Examiner had seen to that. But with a few days' head start, she might be able to disappear until the fervor died down, or some new bit of schadenfreude captured the world's attention. In the meantime, she needed to put as much distance as possible between herself and Clear Harbor. The only question was how far she'd be able to go before fatigue and the reality of what she'd done finally caught up with her. 2 hours later, she had her answer. Her eyes had begun playing tricks on her several miles back, and more than once, she found herself mesmerized by the strobe effect of the highway's broken white lines. She had no idea where she was when she finally stopped for gas, but she was glad for the chance to stretch her legs. She took a chance on the ladies' room, which reeked of bleach and cherry air freshener, then bought a pair of bottled waters and several packs of nabs. This wasn't her first rodeo. She had subsisted for days on nothing but water and peanut butter crackers, and the less she stopped, the less likely she was to be recognized. She wasn't 16 anymore, wasn't flat broke, wasn't worried about seeing her face on a runaway poster. But somehow, the stakes felt just as high. In fact, she'd spent a good portion of the drive dusting off her street smarts. Never use your real name. Pick one alias and stick with it. Cut your hair. Cover any tattoos. Lose the jewelry. As she pulled back onto the highway, she glanced at her hands on the steering wheel, the ring finger of her left hand conspicuously bare. She'd taken care of the jewelry, at least. The sun was on the wane when she finally crossed over into Virginia. She had eaten the last pack of crackers sometime around noon, and whatever benefit she'd reaped from the hour of sleep grabbed at a New Jersey rest stop had long since worn off. She needed food and sleep, and she needed them soon. Unfortunately, she hadn't a clue where she was. Perhaps it was time to pull out the atlas and just pick a destination. As it turned out, she didn't need the atlas. She had gone only a few miles when she spotted a billboard for Historic Downtown Sweetwater. The name felt familiar, conjuring images of cobbled streets and tiny hole-in-the-wall galleries, a quaint inn with a wishing well in back, and Stephen. Without meaning to, she had stumbled onto one of the tiny towns they had visited on their honeymoon. They had stayed at a small inn whose name she couldn't recall, had eaten fish and chips at a pub called the Rusty Nail, and then hung around for trivia. They'd been happy then, newlyweds with a whole world before them. What had happened to that couple? On impulse, she peeled off at the exit and followed the main road to the center of town. Not much had changed. The town was small and picturesque, the sidewalks lined with trendy shops and locally owned cafes. Her mouth watered at the thought of food, but her first order of business was finding a place to sleep. She pulled into the parking lot of the first inn she saw, an old converted farmhouse called the Fife and Feather. It was small but charming, two stories of clean white clapboard, fronted with black shuttered windows and a small porch of weathered brick. A wreath of magnolia leaves and creamy satin ribbon hung on the front door, reminding Christine with a bit of a jolt that Thanksgiving had come and gone. In the chaos after Stephen's death, the holiday had simply slipped her mind, along with the turkey she had ordered from Longley's. She was still wondering what had become of the unclaimed bird as she stepped into the Fife and Feather's cozy lobby, a snug, low-ceilinged room decorated with Shaker furniture and primitive American folk art. "Hey there!" A pretty blonde stood grinning behind the registration counter. She looked to be in her 30s, but there was an air of prom queen about her, too, perky and bright, with her messy bun and shimmery pink lips. "Welcome to the Fife and Feather." Christine ran a hand through her hair, painfully aware of her bedraggled appearance.
I was driving by and saw the vacancy sign. I'm hoping you still have a room available.
The woman's smile widened as she produced a registration form from somewhere below the counter.
You're in luck. The leaf peepers are gone, and it's too early for Christmas guests. You can pretty much take your pick.
What brings you to Sweetwater?
I'm, just passing through.
So, just the one night, then?
Yes, just one night.
Well, we're happy to have you. I'm Missy Beck, by the way, the owner. And since we're so quiet, I'm putting you in my favorite room.
It was actually the library back when the Holcombs owned it. The bookcases are all original.
Christine didn't have the heart to tell her she wouldn't be paying attention to much of anything except the bed.
Does the inn serve dinner?
Sorry, I'm afraid we're limited to breakfast, but I can offer you one of these to take the edge off.
She held out a plate of what appeared to be freshly baked oatmeal cookies.
Christine took a cookie, nibbling politely.
I don't suppose the rusty nail is still in business by any chance?
Missy looked surprised.
The nail's been closed for years.
It's a pizza place now, and a pretty good one if that's what you're in the mood for. I take it you've been to Sweetwater?
Christine nodded.
Years ago, on my honeymoon.
Oh, nice. Is your husband traveling with you this time through?
No, he's... I'm a widow.
The word stopped her cold. It was the first time she'd said it out loud, and it surprised her how easily it had slipped from her tongue.
Missy reached across the counter to give her hand a squeeze.
Oh, honey, I'm sorry. And you, so young. Was it sudden?
Yes, he was. She paused, realizing she was about to say too much.
He drowned.
It wasn't a lie, but it wasn't the truth either. At least, not all of it. She closed her eyes briefly, trying to dislodge the images that had been haunting her for days.
Had he been conscious? Had he struggled? And if so, for how long before the water had finally filled his lungs?
Missy's gray-green eyes filled with sympathy.
You poor thing. I have a friend who lost her husband a year ago, and I've seen what she's gone through. I know it's hard in the beginning, but it does get easier. Tomorrow will be better. And then the day after that, as long as you have friends, you can get through anything.
Christine managed what she hoped would pass for a smile as she reached for the registration form. She was grateful for the words of comfort. She even wanted to believe them. But if things getting better was dependent on having a circle of friends, she was out of luck. There were a handful of women from the club she'd socialized with now and then, most of them the wives of Stephen's friends. A few had even sent cards filled with condolences, but that's as far as it went, and as far as Christine wanted it to go.
I'm sorry, Missy blurted. You were asking about dinner, and as usual, I went down a rabbit hole.
I definitely recommend the Cork and Cleaver. It's right next door, and the food is wonderful. Queenie Peterson owns it. She's a friend of mine, so I'm a little bit biased, but they really do have the best food in town.
Christine nodded vaguely, staring at the line on the registration form asking for her name. She didn't dare use Ludlow. Instead, she picked up the pen and printed the name she'd given up 8 years ago when she married Stephen. From here on out, she was Christy Lynn Parker. Now all she had to do was remember.
"Do I pay you for the room now?" she asked, when she had completed the form.
"Tomorrow will be fine. Here's your key. Your room is at the top of the stairs. Breakfast is served until 11 in the room right off the stairs. There are no TVs in any of the rooms, but if you really want to know what's going on in the world, there's a television in the business center.
Oh, I almost forgot." She paused, wrapping several cookies in a napkin, and passed them to Christine.
"To tide you over until dinner. Enjoy your stay."
"Thank you. I'm sure I will."
Christy Lynn's legs felt leaden as she mounted the stairs and made her way to the end of the gallery. She experienced a profound rush of relief as she locked her room door behind her. Safely and blessedly alone, she let her bags slide to the floor, too weary to do much beyond surveying her accommodations. It was a bright, spacious room filled with period antiques, including a glorious four-poster bed dripping with vintage lace. And Missy hadn't exaggerated about the bookshelves. They were gorgeous, shelf after shelf stocked with classics bound in worn, jewel-toned leather. Defoe nestled beside Du Maurier, Longfellow beside Kerouac, unlikely friends standing shoulder to shoulder. The thought brought a smile, until she caught her reflection in the bureau mirror. With her stringy hair and rumpled clothes, she looked like a bag lady or an escapee from the local women's prison. What would Stephen say if he could see her now? Nothing good, that was certain. As his wife, her image had been his image, which meant no sweatpants at the market or messy ponytails at the drugstore. But then, he wasn't around to criticize anymore. Still, she couldn't walk into a restaurant looking like she'd just crawled out of a dumpster. 30 minutes later, she emerged from the bathroom blissfully clean and smelling of the lavender bath gel Missy provided for her guests. The plan had been to dry her hair, pull on fresh clothes, and head next door for dinner. But the effort required to carry it out suddenly seemed Herculean. Instead, she fetched Missy's napkin-wrapped cookies from the pocket of her coat. They might not qualify as dinner, but she didn't have to get dressed to eat them. She devoured them in minutes, still wrapped in her towel, then lay back against the creamy lace counterpane. Missy's words drifted through her head as she closed her eyes. "Tomorrow will be better." She hoped so. Christy Lynn Parker. Christy Lynn Parker. The name seemed to throb like a drumbeat in her head as she strolled Sweetwater's downtown streets, a reminder that yesterday she had stepped out of one life and into another. It was a strange feeling to suddenly find yourself unmoored from your own life, to open your eyes in the morning and not know where you are, where you're going, or even what happens next. But it was liberating, too, in a way. The delicious anonymity of simply blending into the scenery of a small town street. It had been years since she'd been able to blend into the scenery back in Clear Harbor. She was heading for the corner deli, humorously named the Fickle Pickle, when her fingers began to cramp. She paused, shifting her shopping bags from one hand to the other. Hippie clothes, Stephen would have called her recent purchases, and maybe they were. They were certainly nothing like the sleek designer labels he preferred she wear, or even the cheap working girl separates she had worn in her early days at Lloyd and Griffin. In fact, now that she thought about it, she was surprised he'd bothered to give her a second look back then. She'd been working as an editor's assistant, still brown bagging it and driving an old Ford Tempo with wind-down windows when they met, hardly trophy wife material. Stephen had been on his way to a marketing lunch with his editor when she literally ran into him in the hall with an armload of cover posters. He had spoken first, apologizing when the collision had clearly been her fault. It irked her to think of it now. One flashed smile and she'd gone all tongue-tied. He had canceled with his editor, inviting her for sushi instead, which she secretly hated but pretended to love. 6 months later, they were married, and the pretending had become more complicated. Christy Lynn shook off the memory, redistributed her shopping bags, and continued on to the deli. She was reaching for the door when she spotted a sign for the Hair Lair next door and changed direction. An entry chime sounded as she entered the shop. Other than the gum-chewing stylist leaning against one of the shampoo bowls, the place was empty. "Hey there, what can I do you for?" Christy Lynn ran a hand through her shoulder-length hair, suddenly self-conscious. "I'm thinking about going short, maybe adding some highlights. Can you do that?" "Honey, I can do whatever you want if you've got the time." "I mean now. Can you do it right now?" The woman looked around the empty salon and grinned. "I think I might be able to squeeze you in." She stepped closer, running a hand through Christy Lynn's hair with an assessing eye. "You've got good hair. Color shouldn't be a problem. Have a seat." 2 hours later, the stylist, whose name turned out to be Rena, snapped off her blow dryer and spun the chair around to face the mirror. Christy Lynn experienced a moment of confusion as she faced her reflection. It was like looking at a stranger who resembled someone she used to know but had lost touch with. She ran a hand through her hair, shook her head back and forth, savoring the feel of the soft, springy curls against the nape of her neck. Stephen had liked it long, preferably pulled back in a sleek town and country ponytail. She had humored him, of course, as she had with most things. But now she stared at this throwback version of herself. It was as if time had folded in on itself, returning her to the woman she had been before blundering into Stephen with an armload of posters. But that woman had been gritty and independent, a survivor. Was there any trace of her left? 7. The sound of canned mariachi music greeted Christy Lynn as she stepped into the lobby of Taco Loco. She wasn't sure why she came in. She wasn't really hungry, but she wasn't ready to go back to her room at the inn either. And it would appear she wasn't the only one taking advantage of the unseasonably warm evening. The place was jammed, with every table full and several large parties waiting to be seated. The hostess, a frazzled woman with a head full of blue-black hair, was doing her best to greet guests and manage the wait list. Christy Lynn had just managed to catch her eye when she heard someone calling her name. After a quick scan of the tables, she saw Missy near the back of the restaurant, waving frantically. "Oh my lord, it is you," she gushed, when Christy Lynn had finally made her way over. "I wasn't sure at first. Look at your hair. Did you know you were going to do that when you left this morning?" Christy Lynn tucked the freshly cropped strands behind her ears, suddenly self-conscious. It was like part of her was missing. "I didn't. I was on my way to grab some lunch when I saw the salon and thought, why not?" "Well, I just love it. It's fun and really sexy. Don't you think, Dar?" "Oh, sorry. I almost forgot. This is Dar Setters. She runs the New Age shop on Bond Street. Crystals, candles, that sort of thing. Hey, why don't you eat with us? We just sat down." Christy Lynn smiled awkwardly at the blonde seated across from Missy. "Thanks, but I don't want to crash your dinner. I just put my name on the list." Dar smiled. She was pale and petite, almost ethereal, her head of silver blonde hair framing her small face like a halo of moonlight. "Don't be silly. Missy was just telling me about you. I'm sorry to hear about your husband." Christy Lynn wasn't sure she liked being the topic of conversation, but forced a smile. "Thank you. It's awfully nice of you to include me." "Don't be silly," Missy said, pulling out the chair next to her. "We're not going to sit here and let you eat by yourself. You need to be with friends. Besides, it's margarita night." Missy's gaze strayed briefly as a waiter in snug-fitting black slacks moved past with a tray balanced on one shoulder. "The scenery's not bad either." Dar sighed and snapped her fingers. "Focus, Missy." Missy whipped her head around, feigning innocence. "What?" "I thought you said you'd sworn off men." "There's nothing wrong with looking, honey, especially when looking's all you've got time for. Not that anyone's likely to look back. Guys aren't lining up to date a woman with my particular combination of baggage, and certainly not one with Jamba Juice on her jeans. Speaking of which, where did Marco get to? It's time for another margarita." Christy Lynn stole a look at Missy. She was totally gorgeous, outgoing, and appeared to have herself together, a combination that made it hard to believe every man in Sweetwater wasn't jumping through hoops to get her attention. But then, she knew better than most that the face a person chose to show the world wasn't always the real one. Everyone had a story. Not everyone wanted to share. Missy's attention was still on Marco. She watched until he had disappeared through the swinging kitchen door, then turned to Christy Lynn with a grin. "He's fun to look at, but I'm pretty sure he's spoken for. Janice over at Bristow's said he was in the other day and bought a pair of ruby earrings, and she's pretty sure they weren't for his mother." "Poor Missy," Dar sighed, "foiled in love again." "Love?" Missy's eyes went wide. "Good grief. Who said anything about love? Like I said, he's nice to look at, but I've got two little boys at home which is all the testosterone I need in my life at the moment. She feigned a shudder as she turned to Christy Lynn. I bought the whole Love and Marriage t-shirt a few years back, but wound up returning it for a full refund, if you know what I mean.
Defective merchandise?
Missy wrinkled her nose. Something like that. Sorry. Don't be. I'm happy. Mostly. Even if it does feel like my hair's on fire most of the time. It was the mostly that caught Christy Lynn's attention, but she thought it best not to ask. She'd be gone in a few days, and she had her own baggage to carry.
How old are your sons?
6 and 8. Nathan and Christian. Both monsters and both adorable. Divorced, a businesswoman, and a single mom. Christy Lynn was impressed.
How do you do it? Run an inn and raise 2 little boys on your own?
Oh, I have help. My parents live close and I have a great sitter. She's with them now. I feel bad sometimes, leaving them after working all day. But sometimes it feels like all I do is take care of other people. If I didn't get out once in a while, I seriously think I'd lose my mind. Oh, look. Marco's back. She grinned up at him, all but purring. That for me, sugar? He set down Missy's margarita and a fresh basket of chips, then took Christy Lynn's drink order, flashing an Antonio Banderas smile as he turned to leave. Good grief, Dar huffed when Marco was safely out of earshot. I thought you were going to start stuffing dollar bills down his pants. Missy's mossy green eyes gleamed mischievously. Jealous? Dar shook her head slowly, like a teacher with an incorrigible student. Not everyone's looking for tall, dark, and handsome. Some of us are looking for substance, someone capable of holding a conversation, or settling down with a good book. Ah, yes, your soulmate. Dar picked up her wine glass, glaring petulantly as she sipped. Go ahead, make fun, but I'm not the one who married a guy right out of school because I liked the way his jeans fit. Missy picked up her margarita, chasing her lime wedge around with her straw. You've got me there. That's what I did, all right. And all I've got to show for it are 2 beautiful boys I wouldn't trade for the world. She glanced at Christy Lynn then, smiling one of her brilliant smiles. Oh, honey, don't worry about us. We're not fighting. This is how we show our love for each other. We're different as night and day, but she knows I'll always have her back, and I know she'll always have mine. You know how it is with girlfriends. Christy Lynn nodded, but the truth was, she didn't know. She'd heard about the bonds of female friendship, but assumed it to be the stuff of movies and cable TV, imagining it involved lots of Chardonnay and shoe shopping. But now, as she observed the connection between Dar and Missy, she saw that real female friendship bore little resemblance to such trite stereotypes. It was deeper and messier and quite beautiful in its own way. And suddenly, perhaps for the first time, she felt its absence keenly. But there were reasons for that. 8. Monk's Corner, South Carolina, August 9th, 1994. Christy Lynn's gaze slides to the girl walking beside her. The new girl. She has a terrible overbite and a head full of wiry red hair. She's also covered with freckles. None of these things are her fault, of course. But that hasn't stopped the kids at Berkeley High from slapping a bullseye on her back and labeling her a freak. It isn't fair. You can't help who your parents are, or the genes they saddle you with. She jerks her eyes away as the girl turns to look at her. She's used to being invisible, to simply not being seen. So it's a little weird that Linda Neely has suddenly wandered into her usually empty orbit. It had taken some time for Linda to finally speak, almost 2 weeks, but eventually, after days of hovering in the lunchroom and in study hall, she had startled Christy Lynn by blurting out her story. Her family had moved from Norfolk because her father had been transferred to Trident in North Charleston. She didn't have any friends, and she was having trouble in most of her classes, especially English. Her father was threatening to send her back to private school, the kind run by nuns, if she didn't get her grades up by her next report card. It's hard not to feel sorry for her. After 5 moves in 3 years, Christy Lynn knows what it's like to be the new girl, the one everyone stares at and whispers about, the outsider. But over the years, she's gotten used to it, even gotten good at it if there's such a thing, which is why it feels weird to be bringing home a classmate to help her with her term paper. It's not like she doesn't have the time. Her own paper has been finished for a week. Or that she minds, really. Words are her thing. She likes the way they feel, the way they taste. It's just weird. New weird. Awkward weird. They're cutting across the parking lot now, past a dumpster overflowing with beer cans and dirty diapers and cars that haven't moved in months. Christy Lynn wonders if there's any food in the apartment. She doubts it. There's rarely money for cookies or chips these days. Please, God, let there at least be some real Coke. Not the generic stuff her mother brings home when cash is low and there are still 5 days till payday. Linda Neely might be unfortunate looking with her freckles and her big teeth, but her fossil watch and trendy Doc Martens are clearly not from Goodwill. They're climbing the steps now. 3 slabs of broken concrete with weeds growing out of the cracks. From the apartment above, Reba McIntyre's Fancy bleeds through the broken screen, along with a high-pitched wail of a baby. She has always hated the song. Just a little too real life for her taste. There's a tug on her coat sleeve as she digs for her key. Linda's eyes are wide, almost disbelieving. This is where you live? I thought we were just cutting through the parking lot. Christy Lynn is still trying to think of something to say when she realizes the apartment door is ajar. She nudges it open with her knee and peers in. The curtains are drawn, the TV off, nothing out of place. She breathes a sigh of relief. Not a break-in, then. Just her mother, running late as usual and not paying attention when she left for work. Christy Lynn holds the door open as Linda steps across the threshold. She's never brought anyone home. And suddenly she wishes she hadn't today. The apartment is shabby and small, and the greasy scent of tater tots and fried onions lingers in the air from last night's supper. She wonders briefly, as she lets her book bag slide to the floor, what Linda's house smells like. Fried chicken, probably, or pork chops, biscuits and gravy. Green beans with ham hocks and red velvet cake. Linda is still clutching her book bag, eyes round in the gloom as she slowly takes in her surroundings, and Christy Lynn is struck by how it must look to a stranger seeing it for the first time. The dingy shag carpet, worn to the jute in places, the rump-sprung couch left by the previous tenants, the battered coffee table that has seen too many moves. The lamp with a dented shade her mother had salvaged from the dumpster after their last eviction. Thank God, at least, the curtains were closed. It'll be better once they get to her room, she tells herself. Not that her room is great, but it's not as shabby as the living room. There are her beanie babies, the ones not ruined by the rain, and her precious books, painstakingly scored from library sales and secondhand stores. The kinds of things any 14-year-old girl might have in her room. Normal things. She tries not to think about what Linda Neely's room looks like. She doubts her books are secondhand, or that her things have ever been tossed into a parking lot. The thought stings. I thought you said your mother wasn't home. Christy Lynn turns back to her guest. What? Your mother? I thought you said she'd be at work. She is. Linda jerks her chin at the floor. Is that her stuff? Christy Lynn follows Linda's gaze to the trail of items strewn on the carpet. Purse, shoes, keys, jacket. They look like they've been discarded hastily. But that doesn't make sense. Her mother never misses work. At least not for a while now. Not since she dumped Shane Taylor and got hired at the Piggly Wiggly. But Charlene Parker has been feeling a little off lately, and looking a little off, too, since she started picking up bartending shifts at the getaway lounge, burning the candle at both ends to keep the rent paid and the lights on. And then Christy Lynn catches a whiff of something sour over the lingering aroma of last night's supper. It's acidic and vaguely familiar, like the stench of spoiled milk. She knows that smell, knows what it is and what it means. There's a moan from somewhere down the hall, a low grating sound that sends a chill down Christy Lynn's spine. It comes again, louder now, ending in a series of coughs and spluttered retches. Something hot and hideous scorches up into Christy Lynn's throat as she heads down the narrow hall. Rage, dread, the awful realization that it's starting all over again. Please, please let her be wrong. But she isn't wrong. Charlene Parker is draped over the toilet when Christy Lynn walks into the bathroom. Her hair and clothes are streaked with vomit, her cheeks smeared with a soup of purple eyeliner and melting mascara. Mama? Charlene lifts her head, her pale face a ruin. Baby, I'm sick. Her voice is thick and slurred, her eyes unfocused. And then suddenly she's scrambling onto all fours, back arched as she retches emptily into the bowl, heaving as if she's trying to turn herself inside out. Panicked, Christy Lynn drops down on one knee, doing her best to avoid the splatters of yellow-green goo that seem to be everywhere. The mingled reek of alcohol and bile is overpowering. By the time the retching finally subsides, her mother's face has become a blur. Christy Lynn swipes impatiently at her tears, but they keep coming, running unchecked down her cheeks. You promised, Mama. You said no more. Her mother's eyes open slowly, heavy-lidded as she drags a hand across her mouth. Thirsty. It's little more than a cracked whisper. And for a moment, Christy Lynn's anger turns to pity. She's reaching for the glass on the sink when she notices that her mother is still wearing her bartending clothes, jeans and a skimpy black tank top instead of her cashier's uniform. Had she not even bothered to come home last night? Mama, how long have you been here like this? Thirsty, Charlene wails like a petulant child. The words ring in the tiled space. And then, without warning, she begins to cry, great ragged sobs that rack her knobby shoulders. I'm sorry, baby. I'm so sorry. She reaches for the front of Christy Lynn's shirt, using it as leverage as she curls her body in on itself. Don't be mad, she croons as she begins to rock. Please, baby, don't be mad. A bit of movement, perhaps an intake of breath, makes Christy Lynn turn. Linda is standing in the doorway, transfixed by the sight of a grown woman whimpering like a baby on the bathroom floor. Christy Lynn blinks at her, her throat suddenly full of razor blades. My mother's sick, she manages, struggling against the fresh round of tears she will not let come. You'd better go. Linda nods slowly, her expression part horror, part fascination. Sure, yeah. She backs slowly out of the doorway, unable to tear her eyes away. See you in class. Christy Lynn says nothing, wondering as Linda backs away how long it will take for the story to spread through the halls of Berkeley High. Then she looks down at her mother, asleep or very near to it, her sticky dark hair fanned out on the bathroom tiles. She had been the prettiest girl in Monk's Corner once, a poor man's Ava Gardner. At least that's how her mother told it. And once upon a time, it might have been true. 9. Sweetwater, Virginia, November 29th, 2016. Christy Lynn stared at the sea of papers scattered about her on the bed, documents hastily scooped from Stephen's safe the night she left Clear Harbor. The idea had been to get them into some kind of order. Sadly, they were more of a mess than when she'd started. Last night's dinner with Missy and Dar had been a pleasant surprise, but when Dar asked if she'd given any thought to what her future plans might be, she had frozen. The truth was,